Colson, Psychology in Education, Friend or Foe. That's his title. And then I'll talk about self-actualization and values clarification. And finally, take a look at how psychology has taken over the role of religion in our society. So that'll be, I think that'll flow better than to plunge into a talk immediately on original sin, which was my original intention. But I think it works better if we just do all the psychological stuff this morning, and then I'll do the original sin tonight, and then tomorrow we'll talk about Christian anthropology and how it interfaces and how it contrasts with this. So that'll be the approach. Remembering that this is the first time I've done this, so I'm trying to adjust it to see how it flows better, and I think this is a better sequence. Okay, I'd like to start off then by talking a little bit about William Bill Colson, Psychology in Education, Friend or Foe? Bill Colson was the co-author with Carl Rogers of a 17-volume work on non-directive education. And that those 17 volumes have had a great impact on education in the United States. Now, shortly, sometime in the 70s, Bill Colson withdrew from that whole movement, as did Abraham Maslow. But Carl Rogers, in the British expression, soldiered on. He just kept on with his non-directive stuff right up almost until the end. He began at the end. I'll talk about this later this morning. He did begin to ask himself some serious questions as a result of some things that were happening to him. But basically, he kept on with his approach right to the end. Experience has shown, now we have 25 years of experience with this approach. And we're beginning now to see the results of the approach. And in fact, the approach has unfortunately resulted in encouraging the very things it was trying to avoid, such as promiscuity, drugs, and so on. It was not a bad intention at all. The intention was really to help people grow, to help people be self-actualized, to help people make their own decisions, to help people make responsible decisions. But because of the lack of underpinning, of theological underpinning, it really got off on the wrong foot, and it ended up doing exactly what it tried to prevent. So the whole idea of religious humanism is derived in part from Dewey's theories of humanistic education. When I was a student in college, I remember taking a course in the philosophy of education. This was back in the early 50s when Dewey was very, very popular. And my teacher, I recall, was very much opposed to Dewey precisely for this reason, that it was proposing humanistic education as a substitute for religion-based education. Rogers was teaching at the University of Wisconsin courses on non-directive psychotherapy or client-centered psychotherapy. And as I said yesterday, his method was basically to refer people to their own consciousness, their own consciousness. He said, his theory was, you have the answers yourself in the depths of your own consciousness. All you have to do is pull that out. Follow your instincts, follow your feelings, trust yourself, and everything will work out okay. In fact, the Rogerian method did not work with schizophrenics. I was talking with Father Egan, who was here last night from San Diego, and he told me, of course, Rogers ended up in that area at the United States International University in Southern California, near San Diego, near La Jolla. And He recalls a lot of activity that was taking place around Carl Rogers in the 70s and into the 80s. In fact, schizophrenics who were treated with the Rogerian approach got worse. So Rogers decided, well, this is not a good method for schizophrenics. So then it switched. So the other theory was that normal people would benefit from non-judgmental listening and unconditional acceptance. Now, in retrospect, 25 years later, it looks like this didn't work very well either, because people were not willing, or parents were not willing, for their children to become the kind of experimental, growing persons which the approach fostered. Non-directive approaches, in fact, in education have led to more drug usage, more promiscuity, a diminished sense of responsibility, and so forth. Some of you may remember the first group to attempt to implement this method, non-directive education, or student-centered teaching, as it was also called, was the Immaculate Heart Sisters in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles back in the early 70s. During the first year of the program, over 300 sisters left the community. And that community, the Immaculate Heart Sisters, ended up asking for a dispensation from their canonical status as a religious congregation. I don't know what's happened to them since. But practically, the community fell apart. 300 sisters left. And many, many of their schools were closed. I don't remember how many. They had schools all over. They were the biggest teaching order in the Los Angeles Archdiocese. And many of their schools were closed. And that was the result. That was after 1 year of implementing this student-centered teaching, which was based on Rogers' client-centered therapy, but applied to, you can apply that method to marriage. You know, he wrote a book on becoming partners, which was about marriage, the open marriage. I'll talk about that later. This was not Rogers' intention. Now, you know, we have to be careful about saying, well, he wasn't a bad man. He was truly a well-intentioned person. But you know which road is paved with good intentions. What he really wanted to do was to free the nuns to become better Catholics. That was his intention. He wanted them to take responsibility for their faith, for becoming truly dedicated to the work they were doing, and to devote themselves and dedicate themselves to it freely. But in the course of all of these workshops, he brought in a whole team of people, including Bill Colson. And it was shortly after this experience that Colson parted ways with Rogers. Through that year, he had workshops for the sisters especially, and then began to implement some of the things in their school. The problem was, in retrospect, that they became too open to their experiences. You know, the whole Rogerian approach was trust your instincts, trust your feelings, you know what the right thing to do is. And it turned out that if by trusting their instincts and trusting their feelings, they were trusting the wrong things, and they were getting into a lot of trouble. Some of them were beginning to experiment sexually. Some of them were beginning to experiment in all different kinds of ways, and they just lost it. They became so absorbed in their own development and their own growth that they became selves, they became persons who belonged only to themselves, and who did not, therefore, could not belong to the church, to the family, to the country, etc. I had, in those early 70s, when I was heavily involved in this kind of group work, some contact with some sisters. I'm not sure if they were Immaculate Heart or not, but I recall a conversation with two sisters particularly, who had very quickly adopted and adapted. You know, they were dressed very smartly in business suits and jewelry and makeup and the rest of it, and being very professional women. And just a casual conversation with them, not that so casual, we talked for a couple of hours, I guess, just convinced me that they were just out for themselves, that what they were after had very little to do with the church, with service to the church, service to God. That was the beginning of the end for Catholic education in this country, of course, you know, because it relied so heavily on the dedication of sisters who were not treated well and were taken advantage of in some ways, but their dedication of working for very little money and working for just basically for survival, but out of a spirit of service and dedication. That's what really made Catholic education possible in this country throughout the first half of the century anyway. Well, that's right. Well, see, but the thing is that the resentment only came forth when they were told that that maybe they should be resentful, that they're not being treated right, or before that, I don't think they were aware, or that they didn't see it that way. It's a matter of perspective, I think. And I'm not trying to. I'm certainly don't want to go back to the old days, you know, or anything like that. But it happened so fast. It was a devastating period. So openness to experience leads to experiment. When we're open to our own experience, and I know I speak from my own experience too, when we're open to our own experience and we use our experience, our instincts and our feelings as a guide to our actions, we begin to experiment in everything, in all fields. We lose a sense of sin because, you know, if I'm to trust my experience and trust my feelings, then it can't be wrong. I mean, after all, God made me this way. It must be all right for me to act out. So you get involved in this whole, and it's rationalization. You get involved in this whole rationalization thing. And then even doctrines of the faith become matters of choice. You know, I can choose to believe in the resurrection or not. After all, if I choose to believe in the resurrection, that's okay, but I have to respect the opinion of those who don't believe in the resurrection. So you begin to slide into a kind of relativism. You begin to think, well, Jesus was divine, but maybe he was just a man who had a special calling from God. I mean, what difference does it make practically what you believe? Of course, it makes a lot of difference, but I'm playing devil's advocate here. And Colson quotes one parent after a couple of years of this kind of approach in the school where her daughter was going. She went to the principal and she said, "My daughter can lose her faith for nothing at the state university. I don't see why I should have to pay a high tuition to send her to this Catholic school so she can lose her faith." And so, you know, that this whole thing began to impact on Catholic teaching. Colson points out, I think it's a very interesting, I never knew it before I read it or I heard it on one of his tapes, I guess, that the tobacco companies now, Reynolds and some of the other big tobacco companies, are pushing this non-directive approach to teaching children to decide for themselves whether or not they want to smoke. And they're entitling these programs, "Helping Your Children to Say No to Smoking." But the approach is insidious, and this is being paid for millions of dollars by the tobacco companies. But the approach is insidious, because what they're really saying is they're setting up this program so that the children can make up their own minds and take responsibility without any outside influence. And it's not only to say no, but it's also they can say yes, you know, and they're subjected to advertising so the companies who advocate, who are trying to sell cigarettes, are free to advertise and to present this as an option. I mean, after all, children are free to decide for themselves. But parents and churches are not supposed to try to influence the kids, because that is censorship. It's really interfering with the freedom of the kids to choose. So, and that's part of our whole educational scene today. Rogers himself, later on, after he'd been involved in this effort with schools in the training of religious and schools, began to refer to those efforts as this damn thing. He got involved with it, and he could see that it wasn't producing the results he had hoped for, and yet he just pushed it. He just kept on going because he couldn't imagine that there was anything wrong with his theory. It was a tragedy. There have been studies done in which it's been shown, these are statistical studies, that children of college, this is about sexual activity, children of college-educated parents are less likely to be sexually active. Children who are the offspring of parents who go to church are less likely to be active. And children who have had sex education classes are more likely to be active because in this approach, you are encouraged to make up your own mind. See? And yet, the title of the course is Helping Children Say No. But it's also helping them to say yes. It's what it's really teaching them is that it doesn't make any difference what you do as long as you feel good about it. That's all that matters. So there's no objective good, right or wrong. They are being taught subjective morality. And so sex education proponents tend to encourage people to find out and become comfortable with their sexual orientation, whatever it might be. This is in our grade schools. Labeling people according to their sexual orientation tends to flatten and eliminate all moral distinctions. You know, it doesn't matter if you're heterosexual or bisexual or gay or whatever, or a pedophile. I mean, that's all. That really doesn't make any difference. It's how you feel and what feels good to you. That's the only thing. And non-directive approaches are, in fact, everywhere in the schools. They found their way into teacher training institutions whose graduates are now in important positions. You've heard, or maybe even in your areas, have seen in operation programs like DARE and QUEST, and some others. I don't know what all their names are, but these are all based on the encounter group model, and on the Rogerian sort of approach, the helping children decide for themselves. In 1969 already, remember this whole thing got started in 1964 with that Saybrook, Connecticut meeting. And in 1969 already, Abraham Maslow, one of the founding fathers, said, "I get the smell of insanity and death. I get the smell of insanity and death." He was appalled at what was going on in his own classroom. Out of control impulses. Students were becoming unteachable. There was a total loss of respect for teachers, for tradition. There was the loss of a willingness to learn about anything. And of course, the theory of education up until then was that you go to school because you don't know something. And you go to school to learn something that you don't know from people who know about it. You know, I mean, that's why you're sitting here today. I've taken many hours in the last year to do some research and reading, and which you haven't had time to do, and it's not your job to do it. And I'm sharing the results of my research and my reading with you. And you're here because you want to know about this stuff, that this research that I've done, and this thinking that I've done. But the students, at some point, when they began to think that they have the right to make up their own minds about everything, and that their opinion is just as good as anybody else's about anything you care to mention, they didn't respect. They no longer had any respect or any interest in hearing what the teacher said. Well, that's your opinion. That's okay. I'll give it some consideration in the process of making up my own mind about whatever topic we're discussing. So it's a radically different attitude. Maslow saw this as the end of the professions, and in fact, the end of all commitments. Now, I'm kind of exaggerating that this tendency has not, it's an active one, and it's a I think it's an influence, and I think not a benign influence, a negative influence in our schools and in our culture. I'm not hesitant to say that, but it's not so dominant that it's unconquerable or that it can't be. I think the first step is like the first step in any reversal when we're in trouble, when we're in personal trouble. It's like with AA, the first thing you have to do is admit that this thing is out of control, that there's something wrong. Until you've admitted that there's a problem, there's nothing you can do about it. Because until you see it as a problem, then once you see it as a problem, then you're able to begin taking the steps to deal with it as a problem. So, and another, yes? Well, some of them are. A lot of them aren't. I know, for instance, I said yesterday, reading these books this last year and thinking about it, there are some people who are obviously, people like Colson and Paul Witz and Bill Kilpatrick are writing and lecturing about this all over the country. There are magazine articles. You see references to it now. I'm going to quote something in a little while from U.S. News and World Report. So I think there's a beginning of a reversal of the trend. That's what I see happening in the country and in educational circles. I think the same thing is happening in Catholic education. Back in 92, I started to give lectures around the country on the Catholic catechism, on the new catechism. And I found that by and large, the lowest level of educators, the CCD teachers, the classroom, the people who are actually in daily contact with the students, greeted the arrival of the catechism with great relief. They said, finally we have an authoritative text from which to teach, and now if someone asks us what the church teaches, we have a source to go to. The ones that resisted and are still resisting are very often the ones who are in positions of authority on a diocesan level or in the public school level on a school level. Very often it's the executives or the superintendents and that sort of thing who were really grew up during this era and for whom this approach is so ingrained that they really can't see it any other way. It's not malicious. I think we have to be very understanding, but at the same time we have to be firm with them too and say, this has been tried and it isn't working. It hasn't worked in the past. It isn't working now. Look what it's producing. We have to change. And I think it's beginning to change. I think the tide is turning. You can see the first, all these people, now we're talking about 25 years ago, 1970, 25 years ago, all these people who grew up in this are in their 50s now, and they're the ones who are in many influential positions in our colleges, universities, in our high school systems, the principals. So it's going to take a while, and it's hard for them to admit, I mean, it's hard for anybody to admit that, I've spent the last 25 years promoting a philosophy that is basically damaging to the very people I've been wanting to help. That's a very difficult thing for them to do. So I think it's going to be a slow, tough, uphill struggle. And I'm hoping it, I hope it'll happen. I think it's going to happen, but I think it'll happen slowly and maybe with a certain amount of dissension and there'll be some confrontations necessary and so forth. I know already of several people around the country who've been fired, directors of education in two or three dioceses who said to their bishops, I can't believe in this what the catechism teaches. And the bishop said, well, you better go looking for another job. That's happened. And it's too bad, but they've really been so convinced of the rightness of their approach that it's very difficult for them to change. And the attitude has penetrated. I see this attitude. Now, this year, as I've been really studying and thinking about all these things, I see it operative in the church, too, particularly in our liturgies, you know, where everything is ad hoc. Everything has to be done, like every liturgy has to be planned as if it was the first one, from day to day, existentially. And you do all this planning, and then there's a tendency of the stripping of the altars. You take away a lot of the symbolism, the statues and the flowers, and you have the bare table, and the emphasis on the fellowship, you know, on the horizontal dimension of the Eucharist, and the whole transcendental idea, the sacrifice and so forth, is disappearing from a lot of our liturgies. It's become a fellowship. It's become a sharing, and there's no mention of the sacrifice of Christ. And we're, you know, the ministerial priesthood is poo-poo. I mean, it's the priesthood of the faithful. That's the important thing that has to be emphasized. And so it's crept into a lot of areas, including theological areas. And Maslow himself said that the hierarchy of human needs was not meant for children. He said that only about 20% of adults are truly self-actualizing, and he said that children would not be able to handle this material responsibly and intelligently. And nevertheless, this material is commonly used in classrooms today. Advertisers will say, imagine millions of students discussing your products as they're promoting these programs, you know, tobacco. Kids begin to, helping kids decide. I've talked a little bit about that. Discussion can never take the place of teaching. That's what we're beginning to learn again. We've come through a period where everything was based on discussion, and I think it's a safe, after 25 years, it's a safe conclusion that discussion can never take the place of teaching. Parents are now being encouraged not to interfere with their children's decisions. That goes all the way back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau. That's up to you. Children teach children in the discussion method. Children are teaching children. With no interference or influence from teachers or parents, which would be oppressive. Planned Parenthood wants to teach youth to make responsible decisions, so that no one is responsible except the individual. Any other approach to religion, to morality, is called fear-based programs. See, they use these pejorative. We don't want to introduce a fear-based program in our school, in our educational system. Children who have had comprehensive sex education programs are 50% more likely to engage in early sexual activity, since they tend to have less control and are more governed by their feelings. And very often, I mean, children are children. I'm talking even about teenagers. When their feelings and their hormones are raging, they don't think about things like contraception. I mean, you know, it's just, they shouldn't be thinking about it anyway, but they're taught, that's what they're taught about. They are taught about contraceptives, but they're not taught to control. They're taught to trust their feelings. So in this whole approach, there are no right answers, but a process according to which people make decisions which are right for them. And you remember yesterday I talked about the rules in an encounter group, when you get a group together, 10 or 12 people, off in an isolated situation. No put-downs, no criticism, no judgments. But children must have something significant to share. And sometimes children make up stories because, you know, it's like a can you top this? You get a group, and it happens not only with children, but it happens with adults. I experienced it in Chicago with this community building workshop sponsored by the Foundation for Community Encouragement, which is supposed to be based on Scott Peck's writings, but I was not impressed with the program. Anyway, there was a story, and it's an anecdote, it's a true story, about the children who were sharing one day about difficulties they're having at home. And, you know, one kid said, well, my brother and sister had a fight last night. And then this little girl, really, there was nothing special that had happened in her family, but she felt pressure to say something. So she said, well, I was awake last night and I heard my parents talking about getting divorced, which was not true at all. But she said it in the class. And then about 2 days later, the mother got a call from one of her friends. Oh, dear, I'm so sorry to hear that you and your husband are thinking about getting divorced. Well, where did you get that idea? That's not true. Well, my little girl came home and said that your little girl had said it in one of these sharing groups. So they feel compelled to share something significant, you know, in these discussion groups. And often it leads to this kind of a personal sharing that really, even if it's true, it's not a matter for discussion in a classroom setting. So wrong is defined as, would I be sorry afterwards? If I do this, would I be sorry afterwards? Then it's wrong. If I would feel good about it afterwards, then it's okay. And I think it's Colson that mentions that Hitler and Stalin would not be wrong because they never felt sorry about what they had done, as far as we can tell. Now, the other thing that goes on in these classroom situations is this building up of self-esteem. I'll be talking about that a little bit more in detail a little bit later this morning. But children are encouraged to think that they are the most wonderful persons in the world. You know, I am the most wonderful person in the world. So what I do must be okay. Children are taught that they have a choice about anything. And of course, I'll talk later about when if you've ever read, and I'll go into some of the interpretation of the stuff on morality in the Catechism, the John Paul II's encyclical on Veritatis Splendor, the whole thrust of that encyclical and Evangelium Vitae is the fact that there are certain actions which are simply objectively wrong. It doesn't matter what your motive is. Culpability is an entirely different question. Imputability is an entirely different question. But there are certain actions that are objectively wrong. And in the educational system that many of our children are being exposed to, that's not the case. They're being taught that they have the choice. James Kavanaugh was, do you remember, have you ever heard, remember James Kavanaugh? Some of you must have heard of him. He wrote a book called A Catholic Takes a Look at His Outdated Church. And he left the priesthood. And then he was married twice and divorced twice. And then he was a licensed psychologist in the state of California. And in 1989, that's only 7 years ago, he lost his license as a psychotherapist because he was abusing his privileged position as a therapist and having sex routinely with his patients. And he didn't see anything wrong with it. But the state of California saw something wrong with it. And now the state of California, before they issue a license, has psychological counseling, has them sign that they've read this statement, something to the effect that the state of California does not allow sexual activity between a psychological counselor and a client. Even if you feel it's all right or if you think it's good, it's not permitted. And you have to sign that before they'll give you a license. They say it on the paper, yeah. I mean, it's gone so far that the state just had to step in with a heavy hand, you know. So that's what it's come to.
He defended the adultery, and Kavanaugh himself defended, can't understand what's wrong. The state doesn't understand. You know, this is, I mean, it's so ingrained, this whole idea is so ingrained that he's convinced that there's no such thing as an immoral act. There was one nun, I don't know if she was an Immaculate Heart sister, but she left, well, it's almost funny, but she's become a lesbian goat herd. She has a herd of goats somewhere that she takes care of, and she experimented with all kinds of weird sex and she witchcraft and all the rest of it, and you know, and now she's somewhere in the, I think in the, like, Carolinas or West Virginia or someplace like that. So anyway, well, that's about the worst of it. I you know, really, I don't mean to paint such a dark picture, but it's there. I'm emphasizing one aspect, because it follows from all these ideas that we talked about. And some of it is really insidious, and it's not, I think maybe the devil might be at work somewhere in the, you know, in the atmosphere, but I don't think people who are espousing these ideas are doing so out of the best possible motives. They're not evil people, by and large. They're well-meaning people, absolutely well-meaning people. Now, I'd like to say a word about values clarification. That's a big word today. When I was in Chicago at the Catholic Theological Union until 1979. And I was asked to come back to the Abbey in Wisconsin to take charge of fundraising, of all things. You know, abbot, religious superiors and bishops sometimes have inspirations, which God knows where they come from. But I know my abbot came to see me in Chicago, and he said, well, I'd like you to come back. I had just been promoted and granted tenure at the Catholic University, so I was guaranteed a job for life at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. Full professorship, the whole, and I had big reception. My family came from Massachusetts and California in September. And in January, the abbot came to Chicago and said, Roman, we'd like you to come back to the Abbey and take over this fundraising position. I said, fundraising? I said, look, when I came back, I became novice master, about which I knew nothing. I was crucified for it. I've had 7 good years here in Chicago teaching, which is what I was trained to do. And now you want me to come back and do something again about which I know absolutely nothing. And he said, well, you can learn. And he said, and besides, it's my opinion and the unanimous opinion of my council that you're the right man for the job. So, you know, well, what can you say? So I went, and it turned out not to be a full-time job, and so I went to St. Norbert College and asked them if they had something for me to do. And they said, well, you know, we've been looking for somebody to teach values clarification. And I said, oh, wonderful. This was in 1979. I knew from nothing about values clarification. What's the text? So they gave me a textbook, and I read through it during the summer, and you know, and I spent a semester teaching, mea culpa, teaching values clarification. But you know, I mean, this is how insidious this stuff is. That, remember my background with all this group movement and the workshops and the training and the encounter groups and the heavy personal growth and all this. So, I kind of sensed that there was something missing. As we were going through the semester, but I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And here I am with a doctorate in theology and all kinds of postdoctoral studies, and you know, it really took me another 5 years, around 1985, before I began to look back and say, that's what was wrong with this approach, with the whole value clarification. So I know it a little bit from the inside out. And here again, I have to plead that, you know, we don't mount our chargers and wave our swords and say death to values clarification. It's really not that easy. It's so ingrained in our system. I'm going to give you an example a little bit later. I was just in California last week, and at our abbey out there. And one of the, they have a residential high school, or prep school, really. So I asked one of the priests, who's the principal of the high school, if he had any materials on values clarification. He said, oh, yes. And I said, I want to use it as examples in this one talk that I'm giving next week. And, well, I'll see what I can find. And he found a book that was published by the Ave Maria Press. And I went through it, and I'm going to give you some examples a little bit later on. It's incredible. You know, and it's not, and they have some very good stuff in that book. I mean, they have the teachings of Jesus and making moral decisions and so forth. But right alongside it, they have this other stuff about which I'll tell you. So, what's values clarification? Well, the goal of values clarification is, and this is a quote, to involve students in practical experiences. So you're involving students in practical experiences. And as a result of those practical experiences, you're helping the students to become aware of their own feelings, their own ideas, their own beliefs, their own feelings, their own ideas, their own beliefs, so that the choices and decisions they make are conscious and deliberate based on their own value system. See, I mean, when you first read that, it sounds kind of, doesn't it sound reasonable? I mean, it did at first to me. That's right. That's exactly. It's, but where is this, where is all this derived from? You know, it goes back to Rogers. It's all derived from discussion, from sharing what they think of, from children sharing with children, teaching children. They are asked to use the valuing process. And, Ratz, Simon, and Harmon, I think that was the textbook that I used. Sidney Simon was the big name in values clarification in the 70s. You have to choose your beliefs and behaviors. You have to choose from among options. You have to prize those choices, and you have to act on them. That's the structure of values clarification. Now, I started to tell you yesterday about a values clarification. Before I got into teaching this values clarification, this is on a college level, I had devised, and I didn't realize all the dynamics, but I had devised my own workshop that I called values clarification. And it was kind of a, what I would now call a zinger workshop. What I did was, I started off and I had the participants, I'd had groups, 30, 40, 50 people, I'd have them write out like things like lists, like the 10 most important things in their life, things that they would practically often give their lives for, you know, what are the really most important things in your life? And they'd write, you know, my marriage, honor, country, God, all this sort of thing. And then I'd have to do this thing like write your epitaph. What do you want to be remembered about you? So, a number of things like that, so that they would have a clear notion of what they really believed in, what they thought they believed in. And then I would lead them through a series of values clarification exercises, like you'd tell stories and you'd rank behavior. I had an example, I didn't bring it with me. You tell stories and there are different characters in the story, maybe five characters, and you rank them in terms of acceptable behavior. One might be a seducer, one might be arrogant, one might be unforgiving, one might be, they all have something a little wrong with them. You know, they're not, nobody's perfect in the story. And then you rank them. And then a series of exercises where they have to make specific choices, like case studies. They have to say, what do you feel most comfortable with in these kinds of behaviors? And at the end of that, I would say, now from all of these, this would be like a two and a half day weekend process. Looking back through all of these, what do you see as emerging that is more characteristic of the way you make choices? And then they'd make a list of that. And I say, now go back and compare that list with the list of beliefs that you enunciated at the beginning of the workshop. And it was devastating in many cases, because they found out that what they chose in actual cases were often very different from the ideals that they had espoused, and that there was a tension. And I never helped them pick up the pieces. I said, well, now, you know, you have to work this out. So I don't remember how I ended the workshop. But it was one of those workshops that woman in South Africa really became almost hysterical, because she saw such this gap. And she was a Dutch Reformed, you know, believed in predestination and all the rest of it. So very, very rigid, authoritarian person. It was tough. So that was the kind of workshop. Now, at the heart of this values clarification approach is the assumption about the complete natural goodness of the self. And of course, it's a false assumption. You know, I'll talk tonight about original sin. There are no objective criteria for choosing values in these systems. The emphasis is on self-expression, self-realization. An individual's mental health and happiness constitute the highest good for that individual. And this is achieved through providing a permissive and nourishing environment for the student to discover his or her own innate desires. The system is relativistic and avoids critiquing anyone else's values. The procedures always focus on the isolated individual. Recently I was listening to All Things Considered on National Public Radio, and there was a woman who was an anthropologist who had gone to study this primitive culture. You know, these people who believe in Rousseau and the innate goodness of human nature are always eager to go into some isolated tribe that has not been exposed to Western values to see if Rousseau was right. But they're so convinced of it that I was listening to her, and she wasn't, it was garbage. She was sort of forcing her theories onto the people that she was studying. She wasn't just living with them and letting the truth emerge from their behavior, but she was seeing, you know, there's no patriarchy, everybody's equal, and everybody, they shared different tasks in taking care of the children and so forth. So she was, you know, sort of projecting this ideal system, which the social engineers want to dump on us now. And then the interviewer said to her, well, what about the hunting, and who does the hunting? She said, well, the men really do all the hunting, but the women kill the animals. So she was desperately trying to show how in this primitive culture, men and women were equal. It's just this projection of this these ideals. So they strongly encourage the student to understand reality, to understand morality as self-gratification. So here's some examples. This is from that book I found in California. First of all, it says how to use this book. Rule one: gather information. Gather information. You can't go wrong keeping an open mind and learning as much as you can about your particular dilemma. The educated person doesn't have to fear knowledge. But there are many different voices in today's society. Psychology says, be analytical, fulfill yourself. Consumerism says, be acquisitive, indulge yourself. Secularism says, be realistic, rely on yourself alone. The playgirl, playboy approach says, be sensuous, enjoy yourself. Athleticism says, be strong, discipline yourself. And finally, Jesus says, love God above everything and your neighbor as yourself. Which voices should you believe? Who is worth paying attention to? The second rule will help here. And the second rule is, ask questions. A Chinese proverb puts it well. He who asks a question is a fool for 5 minutes. He who does not ask the question remains a fool forever. So the questions like, what happens if I always indulge myself? What does a sensuous lifestyle bring to me? And we can even ask Jesus, is love truly the key to happiness? That's the second rule. The third rule is discuss. And now this is going to sound very familiar from what I've said before. Allow others to express themselves freely in a friendly atmosphere. Non-judgmental, accepting atmosphere. Really listen to what others are saying. Active listening. These are children. This is, I think it's meant for grades 8 to 12 or 9 to 12 or something. Separate fact from feeling and opinion. Well, that's on the right track. Say what you think and feel, not what you think others want to hear. And finally, have fun. And after you've done rule 3, then here's rule 4. Decide. Decide. And even after you've decided, you can always change your mind, it says. Change, by the way, is a sign of growth. The famous British statesman Sir Winston Churchill once said, a fanatic is one who can't change his mind and won't change the subject. So, and then they have this Reinhold Niebuhr prayer, you know, give us the grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, courage to change the things that should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other. And then I just paged through the book and I made copies. They have 12 lists of, by Marshall Field. This is entitled Christian Values, this chapter. And here are the 12 things. The value of time, the success of perseverance, the pleasure of working, the dignity of simplicity, the worth of character, the power of kindness, and so on and so forth. Which of these do you think is most important? Give examples from your own life that show several of these values to be true. This is Christian values. And then they have a list of values from the gospel, be just to all and so forth, and then you do the same with these. But nowhere is it said, you know, that you must prefer one above the other. And then it says, are humans good or evil? That's another chapter. Are humans good or evil? And it lists 12 questions. It seems like these 12 questions. And you answer yes or no to some of these questions. Politicians are basically honest. Rapists and other violent criminals are probably just sick. They need psychiatric help. Goodwill eventually triumphs over evil. Most people want to do the right thing. Honesty is the best policy, and so on. People generally cheat if given a chance. Review your answers. In general, do you have a positive or negative view of humanity? Write a one-sentence description of how you view the human race. So a 15-year-old kid, child, or younger is asked to develop his own or her own anthropology at this point. And then finally, whom to believe? Now, this one I found very interesting. A list of persuasive techniques with a short description of each and some examples. And then it gives like prejudice, an unwillingness to examine the evidence on behalf of a person, oversimplification, appearance, popularity, slogans, personal attack, rationalization. So it's trying to teach them to be discriminating when they listen to ads, TV ads, and so forth, to see what the techniques are, what the manipulative kinds of little messages are underneath the ad, which is useful to learn. But you can see that, and this is a book that is promoted for Catholic schools, you can see where it's coming from. Now, in all fairness, there are chapters in the book that describe, you know, Christian morality, Jesus tells us we must do this and so forth. But they're alongside every other chapter. I didn't see anything as I went through the book that indicated that it was basically a Christian oriented. You know, they were just Christian alternatives among other options. So it was good that it had that much anyway. I didn't think so. I mean, the only thing that made it Catholic was the fact that it had Catholic, it had an imprimatur. The imprimatur was printed by a Catholic publisher, and it had some of the chapters had to do with Catholic teaching and Catholic doctrine. But you, I didn't see anywhere in the book where it says that, you know, this is right or this is wrong. It was always presented in the way of the options of you must consider this and discuss this and make your own decision. That was the approach in all of this. Now, I'm going to close with, there's been some research that evaluates values clarification. And I think this comes from this. Proponents of values clarification want students to acquire purposeful, proud, positive, and enthusiastic behavior patterns with no reference to right or wrong. The system assumes that the values which children choose without adult intervention will be desirable and good. Some procedures, I told you that anecdote, some procedures violate the privacy of students and their parents. Privacy is an important right which should not be violated lightly. There must be informed consent. Questions are often asked about the interpersonal dynamics of family life. Even in this book, there were questions like, you know, tell about an argument, a recent argument that you've had with your parents. Write a letter to your parents setting forth your point of view about curfew and about, you know, why you should be allowed to stay out later on weekends or whatever it is that you decide you want to do. Value, and one thing that I found, and I can really identify with this as a teacher, it's become popular because it requires no preparation. I mean, all you have to do as a teacher is go in the classroom and say, open your books to page 25, and we'll do this exercise. There's no papers to grade. Everything happens in the classroom. There's nothing you take home. So it requires, and the teacher becomes a facilitator. The techniques fit in with our consumer mentality, where everyone is free to choose what they want. And, of course, finally, it must be rejected, because individual relativism leads to social anarchy. Qualities such as honesty, altruism, heroism, hard work, and loyalty are universally admired, but there is no evidence that they are developed through values clarification. When I was in Albuquerque about a year ago Easter, and I was in a store, and I saw this young man. He was maybe 9, 10 years, no more than 10 or 11 years old, with his mother, and he was walking through the store. And they had a t-shirt, and on the t-shirt it said, if you don't cheat, you mustn't want to win, Bennett. You know, this is on a t-shirt, and his mother is with him. So obviously his mother didn't see anything wrong with that message. So it's absolutely false that the self is entirely good without the slightest tendency to harm or exploit others. We must be on our guard against programs that focus on deciding, choosing, decision-making. They're always relativistic. Rogerian method and others considers that when someone has considered the options and made a decision, that by definition, it's a responsible decision, no matter what the decision is. So there's no right or wrong, and any attempt to influence others is to preach and is to impinge on their freedom of choice. So, what does that do to God, parents, church, country, etc.? People who have AIDS never did anything bad, implying that morality is whatever you decide it is, because we are individually the center of our own decision-making. We construct our own reality. Nothing is wrong except what we determine is wrong for me. Alan Bloom wrote a book called The Closing of the American Mind, which was very popular not too long ago, but a few years ago. And he had this sentence, the closing of the American mind comes from being uncritically open to everything. We're uncritically open to everything, and so we really don't understand anything. Advertisements succeed so well because the advertisers play to an audience while encouraging others not to try to influence the audience. Thus, they are the only ones who are trying to influence others. They have an open field, the advertisers. Moral illiteracy is the aim of the system, so anyone who has strong opinions is considered fundamentalist, or pernicious merely by trying to influence others. So that's the situation. And I feel badly that because maybe I painted a picture that's quite dark, but I think there are some elements of all of this. There are also some bright spots, but I'm not here to take bright spots. I'm here to point out some of these tendencies. So we'll break for now. It's almost 10 o'clock, and we'll come back, I guess, around 10:15. Okay.